Chut, John mentioned it. On the map that we have there, you don't see Elon Chut, but you do see a place called Ephrata. You can't hear me. That's better? Some people say, I don't know how to talk slow. So, Alon Shvut is in this area called Gush Etzion. Gush Etzion is the... Yeah, so you see Ephrata on the map. Ephrata is the city in Gush Etzion. You can look at the map there. You have Jerusalem, then we go down to Bethlehem, Beit Lechem. And if you continue going down, more or less due south, you get to Ephrat, to Gush Etzion, that has an Alon Shvut where I live. We have about 3,000 people in Alon Shvut. 100% of them are Jewish, and I'd say 99% of them are devoutly observant religious Jews, to give you an idea of the type of community that I live in. The map really explains exactly where we are. It's so close to Jerusalem, right between Bethlehem and Hebron, the two biblical cities. I can immediately say that my reference to where I live, where Alon Shvut is, already is a big political debate. It's fraught with emotion and politics. From a Jewish point of view, Alon Shvut is in the county of Gush Etzion, which is in the area of Judea. Or Judah. We call it sometimes liberated territory from a Jewish point of view. We call it Greater Israel. Not so good. On the other, am I allowed to say a word? On the other, what should I do? Keep going. On the other hand, people who don't live where I live and don't have the ideology that myself and my neighbors have call it the West Bank, call it occupied territory, call it disputed territory. There are all different types of names. So the minute I even identify where I live, I already got into hot water. So we have different names for where we live. And furthermore, I apologize. Furthermore, even when I characterize the type of place I live in, many people call it a settlement. And I understand that in certain places, although not where I live, in certain places the word settlement has pejorative connotations, even connotations of illegality. Illegality? Help me out there, guys? Right? So, wherever I live, so it's hard to describe where I live, but wherever I live, it's a piece of ground that's holy to many religions, and it's a piece of ground, piece of sacred geography that many are fighting over and many are losing their lives over. That's my introduction. The way I want to start is trying to bare my soul and explain what this piece of sacred geography means to me and why it means what it means what it means. It goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, to verses that you guys are probably very familiar with. In the very beginning, chapter 12, God says to Abraham, at this point his name is Abram, to leave the land that you're from, leave your birthplace, leave your homeland, go to land that I will show you. A few verses later, it's going to be an eternal inheritance for you and your descendants after you. It's the place to found a nation. A nation, not just a religion, not just a faith, but a nation. A nation needs a land, and this nation is going to have a holy mission to be what we later find in the book of Exodus, to be a holy nation, to be a kingdom of priests, to bring some type of message to the world. And it's a message of nations to nations. It's not merely a message of individuals to individuals. It's a message of nations to nations, and nations, of course, are founded on the supposition that there's land there, that it has a place, that has national infrastructure. So from our point of view, the land is holy land. It's designated for the Jewish people. And that's true for all of the land of Canaan, which is more or less the land where the state of Israel appears today, where the state of Israel is. But what I furthermore want to emphasize is that the biblical heartland of the whole land of Canaan, the biblical heartland where certainly most of the book of Genesis took place and most of future Jewish history after Genesis took place, the biblical heartland is exactly those territories that today are disputed, the disputed territories, the occupied territories, the West Bank, or again from a Jewish perspective, Judah and Samaria. Let me explain why. Where exactly is Judah and Samaria? Judah is the area around Jerusalem and to the south. The area of Samaria is from Jerusalem to the north. If you go to the coast, right, which is where the main population centers of the state of Israel are today, Tel Aviv, Haifa, down to Ashkelon and Ashdod, that's where the major population centers are today. But that's not where Abraham spent most of his time. That's not where Isaac spent most of his time. That's not where most of Jewish history took place, although it is part of the Promised Land. But most of Jewish history took place in Judah and Samaria. Therefore, my heart and the heart of my neighbors, the heart of my co-religionists, my heart is primarily connected to the places where Abraham put his feet. Let's remember, when Abraham came from Mesopotamia to this land, most of his time, look at the book of Genesis, he's spending going on the north-south axis from, here it's called Nablus, in Hebrew it's Shechem, Nablus down to Beit El. Beit El is the area that's there close to Beit Horon. Jerusalem didn't exist then as a city, but through then to Bethlehem, Ephrat is mentioned, Ephrata, that's where Rachel died, in the area of Ephrata near Beit Lechem, and then Avram comes through to Hebron, and he goes down to Beersheba, that's where he is most of his life. In other words, Abraham, 10, 20, 30 times in his life, walked through the piece of land that today is my living room. And that's deeply, deeply seared in the consciousness of the people who are my neighbors and the people who live where I live in Alon Shvut, in Ephrat, in Gush Etzion, in all of Judah and Samaria. Keep in mind, for example, that when Abraham got the command from God to put his son Isaac upon the altar, where was he when he heard that command? Anyone know? What city? He was in Beersheba. And at least according to Jewish tradition, it's not explicit in the book of Genesis, according to Jewish tradition, the command was to go to that mountain that I will show you. That mountain was Har HaMoriah, what later became Jerusalem, which means that to go to the Akedah, to the binding of Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, Abraham went from Beersheba to Jerusalem. In other words, again, he walked through my living room. Same thing with Isaac, same thing with Jacob. This is where the book of Genesis takes place, in the biblical heartland. Remember that all of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are buried in, anyone remember where they're buried? In Hebron, right? Some of you were there. In Hebrew, it's called Marata Machpelah, the double cave in Hebron. That's 20 minutes from my house by car. I go and pray there twice a year. From a Jewish perspective, that's deeply holy ground. By the way, 2,000 years ago, call it a mausoleum, a monument was built over the caves of the patriarchs and the matriarchs in Hebron, Marata Machpelah, as I just mentioned. That building, built by King Herod and expanded by later generations of both Christians and Muslims, that building still exists today, and it's a place where Jews pray and it's a place where Muslims pray as well. And it's not just in the book of Genesis, right? After the difficult time of Israelite slavery in the land of Egypt and then 40 years in the desert, when the Israelite tribes entered into the land to actually begin to establish this Jewish commonwealth, this Israeli commonwealth, which is part of the divine plan from Genesis, well, the central leadership tribe of the 12 tribes was the tribe of Judah. And the land that was allotted to the tribe of Judah is the land that's today called Judah. That's why it's called Judah. And that's why King David, from the tribe of Judah, who was the first major king, he established first his capital in Hebron for 7 years, and then 33 years it was in Jerusalem. In other words, the administrative center, and probably one of the major population centers of the Israelite tribes, land of Israel, was in this area of Judea or Judea, which today is called Gush Etzion. Gush Etzion takes up much of what is Judah. And it's not just in the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It's not just in the time of King David and King Solomon. But further on in Jewish history, this is always where it's happening. This is the major population center. The Jewish kingdom after the time of Solomon, you probably remember, split into two, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians 100 years before the southern kingdom was destroyed. When the northern kingdom was destroyed, all that was left of Jewish population land of Israel was in Judea. And then into exile, when the Babylonians destroyed the first temple, 586 before the Common Era, the Israelites come back after exile, and they come back to the land of Judea. Samaria was something else. Samaria, by and large, the exiles did not go back to Samaria. All through Second Temple period, 500 years before the Common Era, 400, 300, 200, this is where the Jewish population center was. Americans, Christians, Muslims, everyone in America knows the holiday of Hanukkah. All of the battles of Hanukkah, of the Jews trying to regain their independence against the Syrian Greeks, where they took place literally in my backyard. Literally in my backyard. Because that's where the population centers were. Go to the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. Where are the greatest battles? Right there. Go to the year 132, 133, 135 of the Common Era. The last Jewish stand before 2,000 years of exile. It's called the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. The last battle, the final stand of Bar Kokhba, the great Jewish general, was in the city of Beitar, which is right there. We're right above Beit Lechem. In other words, it might sound like I'm a broken record, but that is the heartland, that is the backbone, that is the foundation stone of Jewish existence for all the years that the Jewish people were in the land of Israel, for about 1,000 years, if not longer. When I walk through the hills of Elon Shvut, of Gush Etzion, of Judea, I literally only have to take my foot and scrape the ground a little bit, and you see pottery shards. History is right there. And I say that all I have to do is scrape the ground with my heel, and you find pottery shards in many places.
Broken pottery.
Yes, yeah. From the Second Temple period. The remnants and the evidence of Jewish settlement in the land of Israel, and specifically in the areas I'm talking about, is all around you. And if the pottery shards are not enough, and if the wine presses are not enough, then what about the mikvahs? A mikvah, and I'll explain what I mean, no other people, Christians or Muslims, you know what, I don't know if early Christians made mikvot, they probably did. But certainly not for too many years in the land of Israel. Mikvah is a ritual bath. We have a whole set of laws in the Torah and the five books of Moses about ritual purity and impurity. To go serve God in the temple, you have to be ritually impure. If you've had contact with the dead, you have to immerse yourself in a body of water. In the area, in walking distance of my house, I can literally see 5, 6 mikvaot, mikvahs from the Second Temple period. Why there's so many there? Because my house is about a day's walk to Jerusalem. When you had the pilgrims coming from around the world, in this case we're talking about from the south, from Egypt, from the area that's today Gaza and the Sinai Desert, coming to walk to the temple for pilgrimage festivals. That's Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Well, when they're about a day journey, and then you get to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, you want to immerse yourself, so when you get to the temple, you are pure. Those mikvaot, which we're talking about, carved out stone baths, they're all around. By the way, some of them are in use even today. Okay. So, that's the first part of what I want to talk about. Judea and Samaria, and especially Judah, they are the fulcrum of Jewish history. Then the Jews who live there today, like I said, Elon Shvut is 99% religious observant Jews. The Jews who live in Judah and Samaria today are by and large observant religious Jews who live history, who are part of history, who are energized by history. And it's an amazing feeling, a sensation, sense of connectedness to history when you live where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived, where you live where David and Solomon lived, where you live where all the Jews, the kings, the prophets, and the leaders, where the center of everything that happened was in the past. Part one behind us. Whew. I'm going to read to you a passage from Zechariah. I didn't pronounce that in English, I said in Hebrew, but you got what I was talking about, right? Say it for me, Zechariah. Okay. Thus said the Lord of hosts, there shall yet be old men and old women in the squares of Jerusalem, each with staff in hand because of their great age. And the squares of the city shall be crowded with boys and girls playing in the squares. Thus said the Lord of hosts, though it will seem impossible to the remnant of this people in those days, shall it also be impossible to me? Declares the Lord of hosts. So the prophet Zechariah, he has this amazing dream, this unbelievable prophecy. There'll be a day when the streets and the squares of Jerusalem will be filled with old men and old women and little kids playing, frolicking. There will be normal life someday in the city of Jerusalem. Normal Jewish life. And the prophet says, I'm promising it, but it's really far out. It's hard to believe. It would even be, you might think, hard for God to do such a thing. So the prophet says, no, it's not impossible for God to do. But then you ask yourself, wait a second. What's so miraculous here that there'll be normal everyday life in the streets and the squares of Jerusalem? I mean, it happens in Boca Raton, Florida. It happens in New York. It happens in Brooklyn. It happens in Reston. The people live out their lives. The little kids, there are older people. Why is it a miracle for there to be such a thing in the holy city of Jerusalem? But the answer is simple. It's all a matter of history. It's all a matter of context. You have to know the past, the present. And when the prophet Zechariah was speaking these words, indeed no one would have thought it possible that someday the city of Jerusalem would have within its walls normal, everyday, straightforward life. And why did it seem so impossible? Because at that time the city was empty. There was nothing there. There were only jagged stones where the holy temple used to be, jagged stones in which the foxes were darting in and out. It was an empty, desolate city because it had been destroyed by the Babylonians in the year 586 before the Common Era. The Israelites, the Jews who lived there, the Judeans had been exiled to Babylonia. And now they're in Babylonian exile for already two generations. And who could imagine that the exiles will ever return to their homeland? Who could imagine that there'll ever be again normal life in the streets and in the squares of Jerusalem? Just let me mention for you a verse from the book of Lamentations. Alas, she sits in solitude, referring to the holy city of Jerusalem. The city that was great with people has become like a widow. The greatest among nations, the princess of provinces, has become a tributary. And has history ever seen a nation that's been exiled and been out of its land for two generations? Has history ever seen such a nation come back and rebuild itself? Never. Impossible. So in the historical context in which Zechariah is speaking, it's not going to happen. It can happen. It would be impossible. It would be astounding for such a thing actually to take place. But you know what? It took place. It happened. After 70 years of Babylonian exile, the refugees returned. The Israelites returned. And they were as dreamers, as it says in Psalms. They streamed back into the land. Indeed, there were trials and tribulations, right? There were false starts and not a little foundering and faltering, but the second Jewish commonwealth was established. Years it took, much blood, sweat, tears. In the end, Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, They lived to see the impossible come true, to see the streets and the squares filled with little boys and little girls playing, frolicking, getting married, growing up, old people leaning on their canes and sitting on the park benches. It happened. What I'm trying to say is that from a Jewish perspective, normalcy is a dream. It was a dream that came true. It was an unbelievable prophecy that played itself out before our very eyes. Normalcy is the stuff of prophecy for Jews. And then, in our time, in my time, in your time, the exiles have returned again. The first time, after the destruction of the first temple that I just talked about, the exile was 70 years. And they came back. And it was a miracle. But in my time, in the 20th century, it was even a bigger miracle. And the exiles came back not after 70 years, not even after 700 years. The exiles came back after almost 2,000 years, two millennia. If it was a miracle the first time, then it's even a bigger miracle the second time. From my own personal theology, it's a miracle at least as stupendous as the Exodus from Egypt, the splitting of the Red Sea. An amazing thing. And think quantitatively, in the time of the first return, Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Malachi, Zechariah, when they built the second temple, you know how many exiles, how many refugees came back from Babylonia to the land of Israel? Anyone ever look, count in the book of Ezra? 40,000. Only 40,000. A big miracle. In our day, today, there are over 5 million Jews in the land of Israel. That's a lot more than 40,000. That's even a bigger miracle. And to me, it just blows my mind that I had and I have the honor, the merit to live at such a time. And then we ask ourselves, have the annals of history ever seen such a thing? That a nation arises from the ashes? Have there been any parallels like that? Can a Jew or a Christian anywhere in the world not open his eyes to this reality of a mighty dream that we're living? A biblical, prophetic vision taking place before our eyes? I once had a teacher that said, you go to the UN Plaza in New York and you stand tall and you look at the flags waving in the breeze. There are some nations there that were born just yesterday with their flags waving. And the United States has been on this planet barely 200 years. The Chinese nation has a flag that represents a continuous culture of 3,000 years or more. But there's a flag there, the flag of the State of Israel, that represents something that you don't find any place else on this planet. A culture, a nation that was exiled, and after 2,000 years has revitalized, resurrected the same culture, the same religion, the same language, and the same value system from way back when, and brings it all to life. I'm just so blown away that I have the honor and the merit of living at such a time. Okay. Next. I'm still here, right? You're still here?
Take your time, we got to digest it. You got to take a breath if you want.
Thank you. Okay. He's right. So, yes, from my perspective, from a Jewish perspective, it's an amazing miracle. It's a miracle considering the quantitative aspect of it. 2,000 years we were in exile, compared to 70 years the first time. And 5 million Jews compared to 40,000 then. But not just quantitatively is this so stupendous, but qualitatively. What I mean is the following. In this exile of 2,000 years, my people was brought low, very low. The Jewish people were hated, persecuted, raped, murdered. We were harassed. We were exiled. Our history on foreign soil is blood-soaked and wretched. Our books were burnt and our bodies were tortured. Only our souls were left. And then in my parents' generation which some of you were alive, we experienced the worst. Auschwitz, Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, Treblinka. Jews prayed next year in Jerusalem, and the next day they were asphyxiated in the gas chambers. Hitler wished to complete the work, the task that so many generations of anti-Semites had embarked upon. So we were brought very low, and there was almost no hope. They made of us dry bones, and of the dry bones they made ashes, and from the ashes arose smoke. Can ashes live? Can dry bones be resurrected? Can smoke suddenly blossom and become a modern state? Could the emaciated, hollow-eyed inmates of forced labor camps give birth to sovereignty and independence? When darkness covered the earth and mankind was wrapped in a thick cloud, could God shine upon us and His glory be revealed, His prophecies fulfilled? Well, I'll tell you the truth. Had I lived then, I would have answered that question in the negative. No, it's impossible. It looked like it was just about the end of the Jewish people. But everyone in this room tonight knows that the impossible came to fruition and dry bones came to life, just like in the prophecy of the prophet Ezekiel. The hand of the Lord came upon me. He took me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me down in the valley. It was full of bones. He led me all around them. There were very many of them spread over the valley, and they were very dry. He said to me, O mortal, can these bones live again? I replied, O Lord God, only You know. And He said to me, prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus said the Lord God to these bones, I will cause breath to enter you, and you shall live again. I will lay sinews upon you and cover you with flesh and form skin over you. And I will put breath into you, and you shall live again. And you shall know that I am the Lord. I prophesied as I had been commanded. And while I was prophesying, suddenly there was a sound of rattling, and the bones came together, bone to matching bone. I looked, and there were sinews on them, and flesh had grown, and skin had formed over them, but there was no breath in them. Then He said to me, prophesy to the breath, prophesy, O mortal, say to the breath, thus said the Lord God, come, O breath, from the four winds, and breathe into these slain, that they may live again. I prophesied as He commanded me. The breath entered them, and they came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast multitude. And He said to me, O mortal, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up, our hope is gone, we are doomed. Prophesied therefore and say to them, thus said the Lord God, I am going to open your graves and lift you up out of your graves, O my people, and bring you to the land of Israel. You shall know, O my people, that I am the Lord when I have opened your graves and lifted you out of your graves. I will put my breath into you, and you shall live again, and I will set you upon your own soil. Then you shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken and have acted, declares the Lord. The prophecy is about slain, dead people who are resurrected from their graves, bones that come alive. But that part of the prophecy is only the example. It's not the message. The message is not about the resurrection of individuals. The prophecy is saying, of course, that it's impossible for dead individual human beings to come alive, but God can make it happen. And if God could make that happen, then God could make the dry bones representing the Jewish people come alive. And why would we think that the Jewish people are compared to dry bones? Well, I read the verse. Because the Jewish people were saying to themselves in Babylonian exile, after the destruction of the first temple, after two generations of living in a foreign land, they were saying to themselves, our bones are dried up, our hope is gone, we are doomed. And why were they saying that? Because the kids were in Babylonian discotheques. That's why they were saying that. They were saying that because after 40, 50, 60 years of exile, it looked like culturally, it looked like religiously, the Jewish people weren't able to sustain themselves. Without the temple, without the land, it looked like all hope was gone. The elders were losing the remembrance of the past and the hope for the future. The kids were assimilating Babylonian discotheques and speaking Babylonian. They were forgetting the Jewish heritage. They were like dry bones from a spiritual, national perspective. And God says those dry bones can live. And they did. After 70 years of Babylonian exile, 40,000 Israelites came back and created the second temple. And that was the miracle of the dry bones. Well, I'll tell you that after the Holocaust, we Jews were really dry bones. And those dry bones came alive. And that was in our generation. And that just blows my mind. Because again, if I had lived in 1940 or 1945, and you had asked me, is there any hope for the Jewish people? No. Is there ever going to be an independent Jewish state? Of course not. And 3 years later, it was. And 50 years later, I'm living there. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. So, now it starts getting more complicated. So for us Jews, I'm going to summarize something that I said. For us Jews, the land of Israel is our land. First off, because the Bible promises it to us forever. That's one. Two, because we lived there for 1,000 years. That's two. Three, for the past 2,000 years of exile, we still kept a small but continuous presence in the land. That's three. Four, during all these 2,000 years of exile, we've continually hoped and prayed for our restoration. So yeah, the return to the promised land is a big deal. It's a really big deal for me and for us. There's nothing more central to my sense of Judaism and Jewish peoplehood. And now I'm going to say that my take on things is that the centrality of the land of Israel to our self-understanding and the utterly marvelous nature of our return has blinded us Jews to the tragic complexity of the situation. The simple fact is that the land to which we returned was not completely empty of other inhabitants. In a certain sense, We literally didn't see the Arabs who had lived there for almost as long as we had not been there. Or to say it differently, we saw them, but we saw them only as obstacles to the fulfillment of our vision and our narrative. Their presence was a thorn in the side of our miracle, our self-understanding, our story. We could not fathom the violence that they directed against us as we entered the land and began to settle it. It didn't make any sense. And you know what? I'm not sure it would have helped if we did understand where it was coming from. I personally am totally and absolutely immersed in the Jewish narrative. That's everything that I am. And I also was blinded, and I probably still am, blinded to the complexity of the larger picture. But very gradually, and John is part of this, very gradually I've become more aware. My soul has expanded, my eyes have opened, and I am pained and I'm conflicted and I'm confused at the same time that I'm a proud, triumphant returnee after 2,000 years of exile. Both at the same time. So now, we start at 7. I'll probably end another 10 minutes, my presentation, then questions and answers. In the next 10 minutes, as I get into the complexities that I find in my own soul and on the ground where I live, I'm not going to talk about what's happened, and what has happened within the Green Line. The Green Line is what I mean by the Green Line? Right? No. So, That line there, you see Afula at the Jordan River, then Afula, then Kalkilia, that line, Holon, Ramallah, Jerusalem, that line there is separates from Israel from 1948 till 1967. Everything in Israel proper, in other words, in the direction of the Mediterranean, that we call within the Green Line. The area of Judah and Samaria is outside of the Green Line. The West Bank, the occupied territory, the liberated territory, the disputed territory. I'm not going to talk about the situation with the Arab minority within the Green Line. The Arab minority there are citizens with the right to vote, full rights, although suffering a degree of discrimination. It's not part of my experience. I have nothing to say about it. I'm not discounting the difficulties and complexities there, but I don't know about it. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about my backyard. My backyard is Ephrata. My larger backyard is Gush Etzion. My larger backyard is Judah and Samaria, the area there that's outside of the Green Line. So, it's Judah and Samaria from a historical Jewish perspective. It's not part of the state of Israel proper. In 1947, it's basically the area that was designated for an Arab state. In those days, we didn't call it a Palestinian state, an Arab state, but that state never arose. In 1948, with the Arab armies that tried to annihilate the nascent Jewish state, at the end of the war, that area, the West Bank, was annexed by the Kingdom of Jordan. The Arabs living there weren't given citizenship. They were under military occupation for most of the 19 years from 1948 to 1967. In 67, it was conquered by Israel from the conqueror. Israel conquered it from Jordan. And those same Arabs living there, we'll call them Palestinians as they're called today, just as they did not have citizenship under the Jordanians, they did not get citizenship under the Israelis. Why? Because Israel did not annex the territory. Israel kept it in waiting for what would happen. And those people there are still stateless. They've been stateless from 1948 to the present. That's more than a million Palestinians have no passports. They're not part of any state. Together with those over a million Palestinians living in the West Bank / Judah and Samaria, there are, how many today is it? It's over 600,000 Israelis, what the media calls Israeli settlers, who are Israeli citizens with Israeli rights to vote in the Israeli parliament living in the West Bank. What that means is that you have Jews who are citizens of a country living under those country's laws with the right to vote, etc., living side by side with Palestinians who are stateless, have no right to vote in any country, and those Palestinians are living under a different set of laws than the Israelis are living. I am governed by Israeli law, even though I don't live in Israel proper. My Palestinian neighbors are governed by the civil administration / military occupation, and they've been governed by military occupation not just since 67, but since 1948. What I'm about to say in my next sentences, I didn't know until a few months ago. Although I should have known it. My neighbors didn't know it and don't know it today. What I didn't know and I know today is that my Palestinian neighbors suffer from terrible discrimination. And it's an amazing thing that it's right under my nose. It's right under the nose of all of us Israeli settlers, and we don't see it. It's not part of our worldview. It's not in our narrative. The Palestinians are almost literally invisible. Invisible. So what do they suffer from? They suffer from zoning laws that are used to prevent them from expanding their villages and towns. And there are zoning laws. By the way, the zoning laws are not Israeli laws. They're British laws left in the British mandate from before 1948. But they are used by the Israeli government probably consciously and unconsciously, to suppress the local Palestinian population from expanding. Why? Partially out of simple lack of cultural affinity to the Palestinians, lack of cultural understanding, partly to leave the land for Jewish settlement, and partly for security considerations. But whatever reason it is, the fact is that my Palestinian neighbors have no room and no place to build houses for their kids. That's not all. That's not all of the discrimination that they suffer from. Land is often confiscated for security purposes. They have to endure checkpoints, road closures, and limitations upon movement for security considerations. And those are limitations that I don't suffer. I go through those checkpoints being waved through. My neighbor might spend 5, 10, 15 minutes at the checkpoint, perhaps more. Different laws in the same piece of land. At the same time, those checkpoints, those road closures, those limitations upon movement, those curfews, it's documented, have thwarted many, many terrorist attacks and saved many lives, Jewish lives, within Judea and Samaria, and also within Israel proper. But those discriminatory measures, at the same time that they save lives, they make the lives of a million Palestinian human beings difficult, very difficult. Suffering, pain, injustice is perpetrated upon the Palestinian population. And again, I want to say this again, there's no way you can understand what I'm saying. There's no way I can understand what I'm saying. How is it that I didn't see that for 30 years? I didn't notice it. And that my neighbors still don't see. Our narrative, the narrative that I believe in, the narrative that to me is deeply true, that narrative has crowded out the empirical reality that takes place before my eyes. And pleasant truths are not seen. Some people, many that John has come in contact with and has tried to encourage, have begun to see the reality. Now, what does this reality mean for me? This reality, this empirical reality that I see, doesn't tell me that my narrative is false. My narrative for me is 100% true. But I've learned that my truth is only a partial truth, and there's another truth out there, and my truth is impinging on that truth, and I believe both truths are true. I know I'm confusing you. I'm confusing myself. I believe both truths are true. So then what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What are we going to do? So from my point of view, and the point of view of my friends, my neighbors, my co-religionists, because this land, and when I say this land, I mean all the land of Israel, and I include Judah and Samaria, and I specifically mean Judah and Samaria, this life is our soul and our heart. We're not going to give up our homes, at least not without a fight. We're not going to give up our claim to the land. We're not going to pull back within the green line and completely abandon Judah and Samaria, because this is, remember, this is our biblical heartland. And for us, the continued vitality of the Zionist fulfillment depends on being connected to the land that Abraham walked on, the land that Jacob lived and dreamed on, the land that David had his capital on. Our vitality of our lives depends on being there. It nurtured us. It's our formative history. It gave birth to us. We're not going to leave without a fight. But at the same time, I believe we have to make room for the other. We have to make room in our hearts and our consciousness, and then we have to make room physically, geographically, in our sacred geography. We have to find room. We have to absorb the partiality of our truth. There's another narrative. We have to make room in our narrative for their narrative. We have to recognize that there are human beings there that are suffering because of our God-given truth. And to me, it's not possible that our God-given truth is going to cause so much suffering. I have to find room in my truth to bring a little more hope and a little bit more peace and a little bit more basic sustenance and love to the land. I have to recognize the legitimate needs and the legitimate demands of the people who have called me, and I have called them, enemies for so many decades. And it's not easy. It's going to be a long process, and I have no illusions that it's easy, and I'm not even sure it's possible. And you probably don't even know, and John has only begun to know how difficult it really is. There's so much bad blood. There's so much distrust. There's so much fear. And it goes back so far, and it's become rooted in the religious text of Islam and Jerusalem, and of Israel, of the Jewish people. Texts are interpreted in light of past persecution. Texts are interpreted in light of present conflict, and it becomes a religious conflict. People don't know each other. People demonize each other. I want to tell you that the only contact, the major, almost the only contact that Israelis and Palestinians have, we drive on the same roads. But that's it. And when there's an accident, we have to talk to each other. We drive on the same roads, but we live under different laws. Our towns and our villages and our settlements abut one to the other, but we don't know each other. We have different language, different school system, different administrations. The garbage trucks that take my garbage don't take their garbage. Different trucks come to take their garbage. They have a different mayor. They have a different understanding of where they live. I don't even know what their area is called, even though it's 5 minutes down the road from me. I live in Gush Etzion. For them, it's not Gush Etzion. For me, it's Judah. For them, it's Palestine. I want to tell you something. That was a period a few months ago when we were living in two different time zones. The Palestinian Authority changed the clocks at a different time than Israel did. Our clocks went according to Israel. Their clocks went according to Palestine. I had a meeting with someone. We came at different times to the meeting. That's a metaphor for the two different worlds we live in. You live in two different worlds, and you're afraid of the other world, for good reason on both sides. They're afraid of soldiers, and I'm afraid of terrorists. It's really bad, and it's really hard, and the going is really going to be rough. I don't know what the chances of reconciliation are. I have no idea. But I think it has to begin on the simple grassroots level. It's pretty clear to me, and now I'm about to end. Look, that was really good, just 8 o'clock. It's pretty clear to me that the present negotiations, the peace negotiations, are not going to get anywhere. And it's pretty clear to me that even would a miracle occur and it would go somewhere, the implementation wouldn't work. Because on the ground, it's just too complicated. The people just hate each other too much. And therefore, like I said a minute ago, I think there has to begin with learning to get to know your neighbor. It has to be education, it has to be cultural, it has to be daily contact. It has to have a lot to do with religion, with religions finding room for the other and learning not to demonize the other. So what are we doing? What are we doing? I just got back to my home 6 months ago, as I said at the beginning. I've been in Dallas for 8 years. But my interfaith work in Dallas with Muslims and Christians led me to believe that perhaps my next career, as Christians would say, my next calling, is to do interfaith work in the Holy Land. And in the Holy Land that's right outside my front door. And I think, again, it's grassroots. It's people and religions getting to know each other. Why don't I just tell you of the four projects that I am embarking upon. I told this to John. I'm a man of religion. I believe that religion, which presently is playing a very, very negative role in the conflict, I believe it can play a positive role. So I was invited to speak in something called the Global Faith Forum. It sounds like a big name, was really nothing, in a big evangelical church in someplace in the sticks, or record, I didn't mean that, someplace out there in Texas. And Muslim and Christian and Jewish religious leaders were invited, and I was told that I was going to be on a panel, a dialogue, with a man by the name of Dr. Jack Sarah. And they told me that you're going to be paneling with him because he lives in Bethlehem, and you live in Gush Etzion, your neighbors. So talk about your conflicts on the grassroots level. So I said, I never heard of the guy. He's my neighbor. I better go and meet him before the panel discussion took place. So we had coffee together 2 or 3 times. We got to know each other a little bit. He is the president of the Bethlehem Bible College in Palestine, in Bethlehem. It's the only Protestant institution that trains for the seminary, trains pastors for the Middle East. So we had an idea. Why don't we get his students together with rabbinical students during their study and have them talk to each other 4 or 5 times during the year, have an afternoon seminar for 2 or 3 hours. We're working on it. I can say publicly that a very, very prominent rabbi in the city of Efrat, that's Efrat there on the map, when I told about this project, the first thing he said to him, I'm quoting, he said, I'll provide the students. He has many rabbinical students, male and female, and hopefully Dr. Sara will be able to overcome the internal opposition in Palestinian society. Perhaps we'll be able to begin this little project. That's one thing that I hope is going to work out. Another project we have is an organization called the Interfaith Encounter Association in Israel. Interfaith Encounter Association. They arrange little dialogue groups of 5 Israelis and five Jews and 5 Arabs, Muslims or Christians, to talk together on the subject that interest them. Movies, chess, whatever it might be. A group devoted to chess, a group this. So I said, why don't we found a group in the West Bank, in Judea and Samaria, not just in Israel proper. And that's another project that I hope to be working on. A third project is a similar encounter dialogue group, but for rabbis and imams, for religious leaders. That's a bit more complicated. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, whose name I said a few seconds ago and John met, he has already been involved in such things. Those are 3 projects. I'll tell you the 4th project. I have more time, right? 2 more minutes is fine, right? It's just 8 o'clock. Okay, so I'll end just about with this. Then I'll talk about John. This is an interesting story. This is really interesting. So there's an organization called Friendship Across Borders. It's centered in a Palestinian city. I think it's in Beit Jala, which is right near Bethlehem, and in Stuttgart, Germany, and in a city in the south of Israel called Sderot. Sderot is not on the map there. It's below Be'er Sheva. This is Friendship Across Borders. They bring together Germans, Palestinians, and Israelis for dialogue. It works like this. Each separate group, the Palestinians separately, the Israelis separately, and the Germans separately, college students, meet for a 3 or 4 hour seminar once a month during the course of an academic year. Each group learning about themselves, their identity, their culture, how we define identity in the postmodern era, and learning a little bit about the others, about the Germans and about the Palestinians, the Germans learning about the Israelis and the Palestinians. And then they come together in June after all of these months of meeting among themselves. They come together in a 9-day retreat, the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Germans, to meet the other, to break down the boundaries, to understand and to build bridges of communication. I'm told it's fascinating. In a 3-way meeting, it's very often that there are 2 groups at odds and the 3rd serves as a mediator. So when the Germans and the Israelis get into conflict over the Holocaust, the Palestinians serve as mediators. When the Palestinians and the Israelis get into conflict, the Germans serve as mediators. So I met the leaders of this group and they told me about what's happening. Again, Germans, Israelis and Palestinians. I said to them the following. I said, I'm a rabbi. Did you guys ever think of the fact that the Germans are Christians, the Israelis are Jews, and the Palestinians are Muslims? No, they never thought of it. And I said, look, don't you understand that even if these are secular Germans and secular Israelis, and even if they're secular Palestinians, there's religious baggage here. There's religious background, religious understanding, religious residue that could very well be behind some serious conflict, some serious distrust, and religion can also be used to build bridges of understanding. They thought it was a good idea, but that's a strange idea, because the leaders of this organization are very, very secular Muslims, Palestinians, secular Jews, Israelis, secular Germans. But we're working on a project to bring religion into it, and again, to use religion hopefully as a bridge and not only as a battering ram. So that's the, I said all the four projects. And then comes along John. I'm minding my own business, trying to get to know Palestinians in my area, and Jews who are interested in dialogue. And I'm told by one of the people that I just met, because again, I've been back in Israel just for 6 months, that there's this American pastor who is serving as a bridge between neighbors who don't know that they're neighbors, neighbors who don't know yet that they have to learn to get along. And they said, meet John, I'll be happy to meet John. We had a full 3 or 4 hours in my living room just 3 weeks ago. I told him my narrative, and John suggested some solutions to the Arab-Israel conflict, and I shot them all down one by one. And I think, because it's really complicated, But that didn't stop John, thank God. As you heard a little bit, and you'll hear more this Sunday, he managed to build amazing connections with Palestinians in my area and with Jews in my area, and then say, why don't you meet each other? And I'll end with this. Just 2 days before John left Israel, which others would say left Palestine, again, two different narratives here, he was part of being a catalyst to bring together a group of about 50 or 60 settlers and Palestinians who are neighbors but never met each other. I was almost at tears at this cookout gathering powwow when I'm talking to a woman who's dressed in brown, completely from head to toe with her head covered, and she's talking to me. I was blown away. She was talking to me. I was talking to her. And she said to me, I never thought I would talk to a settler. And I said, I never thought I would talk to someone who's on the other side of the fence. But we talked. That's a big accomplishment. And I met her son, and I met her husband. And it turns out that I once lived in a settlement. I live today in Alon Shvud, a big settlement. I once lived in a little settlement, and it was just 20 families. And literally, there was a fence between us and the city of Beit Umar. Beit Umar is right there above Hebron. And these people are from Beit Umar. And we were talking to each other. And a lot of the credit goes to John for bringing neighbors together. And he'll tell you on Sunday more of his bringing neighbors together. And from my perspective, what's more important is he'll keep doing it. Thank you.